Well, here we go, 6:13, Tuesday, September 24th, voting already underway in the presidential election. And Andy Smith joins us, our friend, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, to discuss. How you doing, Andy?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm all right. How's the weather in New Hampshire?
High 50s right now. I think we're going up to 65 today. Beautiful fall day.
Have the leaves begun to change?
Yes, they have. As we call them, the swamp maples are going. The birches and the beeches are turning yellow. Yeah, it's kind of pretty nice out here right now.
They've begun to change here too. As a matter of fact, actually, they've not changed at all. The hurricane came through, blew some of them off the trees, but other than that, they've not changed a bit. Let's talk about the presidential race. How has that changed? How about that? Did you notice that smooth transition?
I think it hasn't changed a whole lot, actually. And that was a good transition. But, there's been a lot of wind blowing, but I don't know if it's really changed much on the ground.
We keep it going, don't we? That's great. Let me ask you this, first of all. I'm looking at this New York Times story. Trump shows signs of strength in Sun Belt battlegrounds. Polls find. I'm looking at undecided voters. As a pollster, how challenging is it for you? Because I would imagine, first of all, I don't answer polls. I guess I should, but I don't. To get people to answer polls. And secondly, do they try to game the system? Do they say they're undecided when they're really not? I know I'm putting you in the mind-reading business here, but tell me about how you navigate all that process, if you will.
Well, I should start off by saying that the whole polling business is in a paradigm shift. We're moving from what used to have best practices for telephone polls. Now telephone polls get response rates around 5%, meaning if you call 100 households, only about 5% will talk with you. And that's true, though, with other methodologies as well. Web-based polls, text and web polls, all of these things result in low response rates because people have other things to do and other ways to distract themselves. So it's very hard. And the people who respond to polls tend to be the ones who are most interested in talking about politics, both on the left and the right. So you do have this problem that the people that you talk to say they're going to vote because they probably are going to vote, but they're not representative, I think, of the entire electorate, because the people that you really want to find out what's going on with are not the people that are hardcore Republicans or Democrats. You want to get those people in the middle who aren't paying that much attention to politics, and it's hard to get a hold of those people. They just have other things to do. They watch cat videos rather than talk about politics in polling.
Do they vote, though?
A lot of them do. Obviously, in the United States, we have a big problem in polling with trying to figure out who's going to vote. It's been going on ever since there's been polling that people overestimate their intentions of voting because we're told every day, all the time, vote. It's important. You got to vote. Bring your kids to the polls and make them vote. So people tell you that they're going to vote when they're not. I would say they overestimate their intentions of voting. And the best studies that look at it show that upwards of 20% or 25% of the people that speak to folks on poll during a poll and say they're going to vote actually end up not voting. So it is a real problem. It's a problem that's been with polling ever since it started. It's really not hard to ask people who they're going to vote for. It's hard to figure out if they're going to show up or not.
So, with all that being said, what do we know about the presidential race?
It's close. That's about as far as I would go as a pollster to say it's going to be pretty close.
You sound like the New Englander sitting back on his porch just rocking. Yeah, it's going to be a close one. About where you are?
I think that's about where it is. It's not that much different than it was in 2020 or 2016. You've got two parties that are pretty much locked down. They've got their supporters that are going to rationalize why their candidate is better. And it's going to come in pretty close down to the few states that people are talking about. If it gets beyond those states, the five or six or seven states that media are talking about now as being the battleground states, it'll be a blowout one way or the other. But I think it's going to be close.
Say that part again.
So if we get beyond those five or six, maybe seven states that are being talked about right now as the battleground states, if the map opens up beyond those, it's going to be a blowout. The Democrats are hoping that goes that way. Republicans are talking about it some places that way. But I think what you're hearing now is just a lot of people having magical wishful thinking about what's going to happen with the election, because the data that we have to rely on is pretty hard to get. Accurate data and polling data, I don't think, is as accurate as a lot of people let on. I think it's interesting that pollsters are far more cautious about looking and relying on polls than are those people who do it for a living in the media. Not the media pollsters, but the talking heads in the media.
What about the candidates themselves? As far as polling,
the candidates themselves?
As far as polling goes, Andy, and deciding where to spend their money and et cetera.
Yeah, they well, the campaign polls are actually the ones that I would pay more attention, but they're really not going to release those polls. So they have a good idea. I wouldn't say so much about what the actual polling is, but a good campaign will know exactly how many voters that they need in each state. They'll have a model of turnout to say, okay, we're going to, I'm picking a number here, we're going to have 5 million people show up in the state, and we need to get, 2.5 million plus one. And where are we going to find those people? We want to have those identified by name down and make sure that we can drag them to the polls on election day. So that kind of information from within the polls are what they're acting on. And they do use that kind of information, and some of it is informed by polls, to decide where they're going to spend the money. I think they're going to spend their money in the same states that they that the media are talking about, because it's probably very close there as well. Like up here in New Hampshire for the last several cycles, going back 20 plus years, it's been a battleground state. Not so much this year. And we're not seeing it. And I talk with people within campaign, and they're saying, no, it looks like the Democrats are going to take New Hampshire this year rather comfortably. And there's no money there.
When you say the same thing here, when you say, we're going to take a break here, we'll pick it up, we come back. But when you say a blowout, and people are wishful thinking, is it because they want their candidate to win, or is it because they just don't want a contested election? And no matter what, you know what, no matter who wins, let's not have any repeat of what we had in 2020. Let's have it a blowout either way, so that at least we know that the continuity of government is there. 6:21, more with Andy Smith. We come back, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. I don't know what would change anybody's mind at this point. I know the polls go into issues about economy, this, that, the other thing, but I think the differences are so marked, I don't know how anybody would really be undecided at this point, but we'll drill down on that. We come back. 6:21, traffic now, WWL. 6:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our good friend Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. I think it was Adlai Stevenson, and who was it the first election we covered, Andy?
I think it was Eisenhower and Stevenson, second one,
yeah,
though,
absolutely.
Not the first one.
Second one, right, not the first one. I'm getting confused. Yeah. So let me go to a couple of texts here, and you can respond. I'm not going to waste an hour to vote for POTUS. Harris will never win Louisiana. But that goes to, there's a hell of a lot more in the ballot than just the presidential election in each state.
Absolutely. And I think that's the problem that I think you're seeing in states like, I'll say, New Hampshire, where we've got a very competitive governor's race. But if Republicans say, you know what, Trump's going to lose here, we're going to stay home, well, the governor, the Republican governor, gubernatorial candidate's likely to lose in a race that, you know, you'd say she should ought to be able to win. So it's the implications of voting and not voting down ticket are really where it matters, because I think and frankly, if you think about it, voting for president, the presidential, what the president does probably is the least important for what happens in your day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. And we get out and vote for that race, but we don't go out and vote for our local elections. Yeah. Where that really determines what your tax bill is going to be, what your schools are like, if they're going to put a stop sign in that street in front of your house where some people keep speeding down the road. Those are the things that we don't bother to vote with, because we get this sucked up in the media coverage of the campaigns rather than thinking about how politics actually impacts us.
Hear, hear. Hear, hear. I wish I had one of those wooden things that they pound on a table with in the UK. Hear, hear. Because you're right. You know what? What's that?
I said, yep. I was being the Yankee up on my porch again.
Yep. You don't give very good directions, do you? Yep. I ain't the one that's lost, am I? So
you can't get there from here.
Yeah. When it comes to, like you're talking about, if the garbage doesn't get picked up, call the White House. Good luck with that. See how they mm-hmm. take care of that for you.
Call your senator.
Says,
won't happen there either.
No, it won't. This is the first time in my life I can remember so many voters from one party says this text endorsing the candidate from the other party. I think Harris wins easily. I think that's some of that wishful thinking. But when it comes to wishful thinking, do you think it's about their candidate winning, or is it just about a peaceful transition? Although former President Trump is not in power, so he wouldn't have the same, I guess, talk about that, if you will, peaceful transition of power and how it would be different since former President Trump is not the incumbent now.
Well, I think you're right. I think that if the Democrats should lose, it would be a peaceful transition, in part because you don't have an incumbent who's running. Mm-hmm. So you don't have as much investment into the office by the people holding office. But I still think that you're not going to see a peaceful transition in the minds of the voters. I think that both Republicans are going to Democrats are so ramped up with this. By that, I mean the activist voters, not right. just the rank and file folks. But the activist voters are so wrapped up about the importance of this campaign. And they've been convinced that this campaign is Armageddon here. If our side loses, the world ends. So
sure.
we're going to have a bad outcome no matter what.
Well, unless it's a landslide either way, what about that?
Well, then I think it'll just be a lot of people complaining and going down into their bunkers, I think. But I don't think we're getting for a period of normal politics for quite some time.
All right. Thank you, Andy Smith. Appreciate it as always. We'll talk about reforming the state's tax code when we come back. And you hear me. I'm like Andy. I don't get all wound up in this. It's not – the country's going to go on either way. 6:30 time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7, sun has come up, lights still twinkling red, white, and blue on the Crescent City Connection. It is Tuesday, September 24th. The storm is heading to Florida, and we'll talk to the National Weather Service about that later on. Daniel Erspammer joins us now, CEO of the Pelican Institute, to talk about a brewing storm of tax reform in Baton Rouge. How you doing, Daniel?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about, I was talking to Steven Nelson yesterday, as a matter of fact, about this, and I can appreciate everything that he's saying, but I'm having a hard time believing politically that any of this is ever going to happen. Thoughts?
You know, this is the million-dollar question. Will there be the political will to actually get this across the finish line? I'm actually in Bossier today. I've been traveling the state, meeting with lawmakers to ask them this very question, and I don't have a definitive answer for you, but I can tell you there is appetite for change. There's appetite to do something. What I'm gathering from lawmakers is they're still not quite sure what, but they're eager to take some action.
Let me rephrase. Let's look at the context of this, okay? How did we get a tax code that is so complicated with so many carve-outs and exemptions?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is we started with a pretty bad tax code, going back to really Huey Long, this idea that you had to come to Baton Rouge and kiss the ring in order to do business. And so we started with a tax code that punished economic growth, and instead of really diving in to solve it, we did this patchwork quilt of, we'll help this industry here and that industry there and this one over here. And so what we have is, you know, as we've talked about before, 432 pages of exemptions in the corporate tax code. And what that means, of course, if you give one person a break or one industry a break to raise the same amount of revenue, you got to tax everybody else more. And so we end up with these inflated rates that drive away business, drive away investment, and it's the worst of all worlds because they don't really fund government all that much either.
So what has changed politically in the environment? Because it started with under the Huey Long, go to Baton Rouge, kiss the ring, but then I guess it morphed into campaign support. I guess what I mean with Huey
sure.
Long, it might have been not just, you know, kiss the ring. It might have been, you know, drop off the money. But then it morphed into campaign support. And I'm just wondering, you know, it's fine to talk about that and to have meetings like they did on last Wednesday, but I just think that once the session starts and the phones start ringing, I don't know. Tell me.
Well, here's the big thing that's changed. We can look around us and see that we are not keeping up. We have the only state in the Sun Belt that has out-migration. In fact, we're the third highest out-migration state in the country. Our kids and grandkids are leaving. You know, it's the one thing I hear consistently. I've spoken in 52 parishes in the last year, and what I hear regularly is my kids had to go to Texas to get a job, or my neighbors moved to Florida, or they went to North Carolina. So there's a palpable sense that Louisiana is falling far, far behind. And it used to be, honestly, even the last few years, we heard from folks saying, you know, Louisiana government sucks, but that's just kind of the way it is. Now we're hearing, we've got to fix this. I've got to bring my kids and grandkids home. And so, you know, whether it's anecdotes like that or the real facts of the fact that we have all these assets and yet we're the only state in our region that's stagnant and failing, there is a desire, maybe for the first time in a long time, to try to solve that problem.
And I understand all of that, but again, and I'm not trying to be cynical here, Daniel, but you know, during that session when you know the representative goes back to his office I'm going to make up some names here. It's like, Representative, this is Gary Carlson here. What the hell's going on over there? I'm worried about my tax credit here. What do you expect me to do here? I'm going to have to reevaluate my campaign contribution here or something. I thought we had an understanding. You see what I'm saying?
I do. And your cynicism
is—that
was good. Well done. Your cynicism is well earned, because that's absolutely been the story of tax policy in Louisiana, and still remains so. So, you know, I'm not here to tell you that the incentives have changed in terms of the lobbying class or any of that, but I can tell you that the leadership in Baton Rouge and mostly the citizens, right? I mean, the only thing that balances out big campaign contributions and big lobbying is for lawmakers to hear from their constituents. And I can tell you just anecdotally and talking to lots of citizens and lawmakers, they're starting to make their voices heard. And so that's the only way to balance out an entrenched status quo, is to make it politically popular back home with their voters to make change. And that's hard. People talk about change. They don't really want anything to change. And that you've hit the nail on the head about what the biggest obstacle to getting this done is.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. I do know that, you know, it's the old thing, Daniel, of how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time. Maybe that's the way you go about this. I don't know. Is it going to be evolution or revolution when it comes to changing the state's tax code? We'll talk about it when we come back. 651, 9 till 7, Traffic Now, WWL. 6:55, 5 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. We talked to Richard Nelson yesterday, Revenue Secretary, about his plans for tax reform. Daniel Erspammer's with the Pelican Institute. He's been saying the same thing, beating the same drum for a long time. Daniel, is there a way to go about this where it's like eating an elephant? You do it one bite at a time, or does it have to be, and can it be an evolution, not a revolution, or does it have to be a pretty substantial change?
You know, I think there's something in the middle. I think there certainly, you could construct this any way you wanted. And I think, you know, what we would propose is directionally similar to what Secretary Nelson has said. You know, our proposal is moved to a flat tax on both individual and corporate immediately. That's the eating the elephant part. Mm-hmm. That's the big chunk. But it doesn't do the whole story. Eventually, what we want to do is get down to be genuinely competitive with our neighbors to a zero income tax rate, but do it without major disruption to the state. So, you know, as we look at this, our model suggests that you could get to a 3.5% flat tax on both individual and corporate to begin, with a modest cut in growth of government, and you could solve that by dealing with some of the complexity that we talked about, but you don't have to do that all at once. Some of those you can phase down over time. I spoke to a legislator yesterday, actually, who said, why don't we put a sunset on various tax breaks and tax incentives, and then look at maybe a stair step of phasing some of them out, keeping some of them. So I do think there's a middle ground here. The question, you know, the further we go into removing complexity, the lower the rate can get. And that's the trade-off I know Secretary Nelson presented to the legislature last week, and what is the core of the discussion here.
Give me some benchmarks that we can look for. How do we know if it's going to be, when this is not going to be a special session, this is going to be during the regular session, correct, which is a fiscal session?
Probably. There is some conversation of a special session, but I think, you know, we're operating under the assumption that it could come early, but likely happening in the regular session.
So give me some benchmarks. How do we know if it's going well or if it's going not so well? How are you going to be watching this, Daniel?
Yeah, I think we're going to be watching to see, is there alignment and leadership among the legislative leaders? Does the governor, the Senate president, and the speaker align on and present a plan to the public and stump for it? Are we starting to see specifics discussed among legislators and the media? And are voters, our citizens, constituents, contacting and engaging with the legislature? And I think that there's a direct relationship between how bold the plan is and how engaged the public will be. To the extent it's small steps, I think you get people less excited. But the political risk inside that capital is perhaps less. On the other hand, you can excite your voter base and really give a spur to the economy. But you have to deal with political consequences. One last thing I'll mention is we've run a model on this, and just getting to a flat tax, in year one alone, the projections are $2 billion in new economic activity and 5,000 new jobs. This is how much this can spur the economy.
But there's a lot more involved when it comes to attracting businesses, right, with education and insurance rates and those kind of things as well?
No doubt about it, but the tax code has a huge impact overall.
Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate your time. Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. We're going to take a break. We come back. We're talking to Bruce Jenelson, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. He previously worked in the State Department and on a Middle East peace process about what's going on over with the Israel-Hamas war, Hezbollah, Lebanon, and more. And then we're going to talk to Mark Drews. Mark's the director of public works for Jefferson Parish about preventing flooding to Jefferson Parish like we saw in Francine. They can do it, but it would cost billions of dollars. Bruce Jenelson joins us, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University. Our friend previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East peace process. He knows the region, knows the players, been involved in all of this. Good morning, Bruce. How are you?
I'm okay, Tommy. Hope you are as well.
I am, sir. If you could take a little bit of time with us this morning, because I think sometimes this all blurs into, yeah, well, people over there are blowing each other up. They've been blowing each other up for a while, but there's a lot more context than that. There's a lot more nuance than that. And if you can maybe, I guess, take us back to October, almost a year ago?
Yeah, pretty much. October 7th will be 1 year coming up on us.
And what happened then was there were a group of
Hamas terrorists penetrated the border of Israel pretty massively and slaughtered some 1,200 people, took a couple hundred hostage, and the slaughtering was in little villages called kibbutzes. It was all these young people at a music festival that was down in that area of Israel. The worst terrorist attack on Israel in its history, the most killing of Jews in any single day since the Nazi Holocaust. And then, you know, in the weeks following, Israel mounted a massive war in Gaza, and it's taken a huge toll. Estimates of over 40,000 Palestinians, you know, predominantly civilians killed over there. And as you and I have talked about a lot of times, there's all sorts of other possibilities of escalation. And now, you know, we're looking at what's happening in Lebanon as a real, real risk of the war spreading even more.
So, just to kind of bring people up to speed here, I'm having a hard time here, Bruce. West Bank, What am I thinking of? The area where they came from? Where
in Gaza?
Gaza. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Sure.
I'm having one of those mornings. Gaza. The people that live in Gaza are there. Why? How did they get there?
You know, this goes way back to 1948, when that whole area was colonies, mostly of Britain. And after World War II, the decision was made by the United Nations, one of its first major decisions, to partition the area into a state of Israel and a state of Palestine. And borders were drawn, at least on paper. And two things happened, to be honest. One was the Arab countries surrounding Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, didn't want Israel to be created, and they started a war against Israel to prevent its creation. And secondly, Israel, from the area that was going to be Israel, forced out many, many Palestinians who've been living there for generations. And the Palestinians call it the Nakba, the disaster. And that kind of started us where we're 75 years later on, you know, frequent wars, people living under occupation, Israeli occupation, Palestinians being kept in refugee camps. And then since October 7th, you know, it really went to the proverbial next level with all of the violence and the terrorism and the Israeli war and the risks all around on all these other borders.
I'll be honest about this, Bruce. You know what caused my problems? They put a new computer in here, and I was trying to zoom in on a map of Israel, and it kept crashing on me, and that's why I was fumbling and rumbling and stumbling so much. It's sometimes the most minor things, isn't it, that can cause you problems?
Yeah, I got to watch these technologies. When they switch my computer, it takes me a week with all my IT guys to feel comfortable again.
I'm trying to zoom in on a damn map, and I'm sounding like I've never even read anything about this at all. What do you know about the hostages? Or how many are remaining, or are they alive or not?
Really hard to tell. Fewer and fewer. You know, there was the murder of six hostages a couple weeks ago, including an American one. And, you know, much of the protest in Israel against the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been along the lines of hostages first. You know, there's a lot of, you know, belief in Israel that, you know, let's get to a ceasefire. They don't trust Hamas, but they know how terrible the situation is, and let's bring the hostages home. And there are fewer and fewer. We don't know how many are still alive. There have been a couple rescues, and some of the rescues have, you know, brought some home. But, you know, we're right on the eve of the beginning of the Jewish New Year, the high holy days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and you can only imagine the grief and the stress for Israelis, and also the Israelis who've been displaced. You know, over 100,000 Israelis who live near Lebanon and live near Gaza have been forced away from their homes into, you know, living in hotels and the like. At the same time, you know, Palestinians are living in rubble. You know, 40,000 or so have been killed. Hospitals have been attacked. Schools have been attacked. You know, suffering, deep suffering on both sides.
I want to talk about these pager and walkie-talkie attacks when we come back, if we can, or I guess it's attack. I don't know what else word you'd use for him. Bruce Gentleson, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Targeted hits, if you want. Previously worked in the State Department on a Middle East peace process. 720, traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Bruce Gentleson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University. Previously worked in a State Department on the Middle East peace process, talking about what's going on in the Middle East with Israel and Hezbollah and Lebanon and exploding pagers. It's easy, Bruce, for some people who want to put a white hat on one guy, a black hat on another woman or whatever gender, and make it good guys and bad guys. In this case, it's really not that simple, is it?
No, you're absolutely right. And what the Israelis did last week or so was somehow broke into the supply chain of pagers that Hezbollah and others were using. Hezbollah is the Shiite militia that's been the most active attacking Israel from southern Lebanon. And, you know, blew them up, but also blew up, you know, innocent civilians, women and children. And, you know, the Israelis think that this would make Hezbollah less likely to continue attacking them because you've shown you can get at them, you've disrupted their communications, you've killed some people. But the other side of it is not in any way saying Hezbollah has a white hat, but this can be counterproductive, that it looks like it's leading to an escalation. This morning, Israel further air attacks on Lebanon, killing more people. And it's not clear that Hezbollah is going to say, okay, I'm afraid of you, I'm going to step back. They're going to escalate. And the risk now of Israel having another war on its northern front, at the same time it's fighting in Gaza on its south and west, and then it's possibly spreading elsewhere, you know, is getting, you know, the risk is getting higher and higher now. And it's not a question of whether, you know, Hezbollah deserves it. It's whether, you know, is this working for you, Israel? Is this really working for you? And I'm not sure it is.
It seems like there's a difference between collateral damage and indiscriminate killing.
Yeah, especially with something like this, where pagers are blowing up in, you know, in shops, in grocery stores, in cafes. And, you know, there are many, you know, many Israelis that I know pretty well who are hard, you know, hawkish military strategists, intelligence veterans, who not only, you know, it's not just that they worry about the humanitarian toll. They're the ones saying to the government, this is counterproductive for us, right? So you've got two things, both the toll it's taking and the criticism Israel gets for killing innocent people. And Hezbollah is also killing innocent people. But those who are, you know, real military strategists saying, even if I were to look the other way at that, this is not working for us. It's not making us more secure.
Because you would have to imagine, and I saw the video in a grocery store of, you know, your kid standing next to somebody that happens to be a terrorist, and all of a sudden your kid's dead because they happen to be standing to it next to a terrorist that the Israelis decided to take out with an exploding pager. That's not overdramatic, is it?
No, and it's, you know, I mean, if we were to think about this, and not just Israel and Hezbollah, but another situation, you know, somebody threatens somebody or takes a punch at them, thinking that's going to intimidate them. Well, oftentimes it leads the person to fight back and escalate, even if, you know, even if you're stronger than them. And right now, Israel's military has been at war for a year. You know, it's deeply strained. Its economy is strained. Airlines, you know, sometimes stop flying to Israel, not protesting politically, but because they're worried about the safety of their crews and passengers. And again, this is a, you know, this is not a who's right, who's wrong. You know, it's just some hard-headed strategy for Israel that this is making you less secure, not more, as well as the, you know, humanitarian and ethical questions about blowing people up in grocery stores.
Yeah, you and I have had this conversation before, but it seems like the conversation is you blow up our kids, we're going to blow up your kids, when what's getting lost in all of this is it's wrong to blow up kids.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. Because Israelis are suffering, too. You know, they've been attacked, and people are being killed in Israel. Kids are being traumatized, even if they're not being killed. Sometimes people look at just one side, and I think what you and I are talking about is you got to look at both sides here and then figure out, you know, what your views are.
Yep, and again, determine the difference between collateral damage and indiscriminate killing. Thank you. Bruce, appreciate your time. As always, Bruce Jenelson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department on the Middle East peace process. And for those of you that would text in and say, yeah, well, the people in Gaza voted for Hamas, some did, some didn't. Either way, it's not what they expected. And I don't think you can justify under any circumstance your child standing in a supermarket being blown apart because they happen to be standing next to a terrorist who had an exploding pager. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish, about preventing flooding in Jefferson Parish in the future. Right now it's time for WWL for 7:45, quarter till 8, getting ready to talk to Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish, about preventing flooding. And like we saw after Francine, the total is in, I think they're talking about over 700 houses that took on water. And what can be done, somebody texted in and said that instant gratification is never going to work, that if you want to improve drainage, it must start with mitigation, retention, and stormwater storage. Real-time pumping and instant gratification will never be the solution. With that, we welcome in Mark Drews, Director of Public Works, Jefferson Parish. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing just fine, Tommy. How you doing?
All right. Tell me, first of all, since we spoke last and since Francine, what have you learned, and what have what's come to light, I guess, about the flooding incidents with Francine?
I think what we've learned from this event, which overwhelmed the system, is we have some maps that are coming out that show us where the predominant flooding was, which will help us try to address future events such as this. So we know where the, you know, the weak points per se are. I can tell you, like, Northwest Kenner was probably the worst hit area, talking just north of I-10 to the lake. So with that said, we can take a look specifically at those areas and other areas that, we see and try to work to maybe address those with additional pumping capacity if possible.
So can you do it, like, partially, or is it – because here's the deal. I'm looking at this story, and it talks about how as the rain continued to fall, you realized that you were in trouble right around 8:30, and I'm just wondering is there ever a way that you'll be able to guarantee that houses don't flood in Jefferson Parish no matter how much you spend? Or even if you triage, as I saw one of the council people talking about, and or go about it strategically? Because I don't know, if it rains that much, Mark, how you ever prevent anything like that.
Well, look, you'll never be guaranteed because you have a mechanical system, Tommy. So no matter what I build, it does have failure points. Can we get to, say, like a 25 or a 50-year storm level for the entire parish and design our system for that? Probably not, because you're talking billions of dollars, which is beyond our reach. But we can continue what we've actually been doing, especially on the perimeter. You know, we can address the areas that are farthest away from our pump stations and take those areas and try to pump those out. For instance, we have the two projects on Veterans Boulevard. We're building pump stations at the 17th Street Canal. Those will pump directly into the 17th Street Canal, and that's an area where we have, you know, historic flooding. But what that does, it will take out roughly 180 CFS, put it in the 17th Street Canal, but it helps the Bonneville pump station, because now that's another 100, roughly 80 CFS it doesn't have to take out. We're going to do the same thing at West Esplanade, help the Bucktown area take out another 150 CFS, which, again, doesn't reach the Bonneville pump station. So we also help other areas. We have one out in Kenner, in Northwest Kenner, where we in the Wood Lake Estates area that's under design, where we would take that area that has flooding issues, take 120 CFS and go right over the flood wall on the western end of the parish in Kenner and take that out of the Duncan Canal. And we're going to look again at other areas similar. Kenner actually has a project. The Duncan Canal runs basically the length of the parish north-south. Well, they have a plan that they're just getting underway to put a pump station at the southern end of that canal, take that water and go right into the river. And it helps that area south Canada, but also takes water out of the Duncan Canal. So there is a strategic way to try to address numerous issues that we saw as a result of this storm.
So let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. But what weaknesses, I guess, as far as you know right now, what weaknesses were exposed that could be immediately addressed as a result of Francine? Mark, if that's not a dumb question.
No, again, that's what I'm saying. You know, basically, we know where the, you know, we have a good idea already, and we'll get a better map as we confirm all the flooding of where our lowest spots are based on that, because that's typically what flooded was, your lowest areas. Mm-hmm. So we know where they are based on this flood. And what's good, not good, but I mean, what the unique nature of this flood is, the entire East Bank was basically blanketed with almost the same amount of water. So that allows me to say, okay, if the whole East Bank is this, where are my worst issues? So it becomes a good tool for us going forward to try to be much better off prepared for, you know, keeping those low areas dry, because I basically now have a blueprint of where those areas are.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Y'all got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. We're talking to Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish. Thankfully, and again, you don't want to wish anything bad on anybody, but thankfully that tropical system is not headed this way. 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish. You know, there's some political back and forth about I guess funding when it comes to new systems and burdens on taxpayers and 737 homes flooded, and I know that costs people a lot of trouble, a lot of money, but there were a lot of houses that didn't flood, so it's always a balancing act, is it not, Mark, between spreading the burden out and being responsible with taxpayer money and getting the most bang for the buck?
Well, it's a little even more than that because, again, it's not just drainage. We have water, sewer systems that are old that also have to be maintained. So there's always going to be a balance in that maintaining your overall infrastructure. But, you know, I think there are some good projects on the books and probably some other projects that we can develop out of this storm where we can, you know, we can make significant improvements to the overall drainage system.
And again, I'm just trying to understand this. Things that would not require extra taxes or would, or where would the money come from and how much money are you talking about?
Well, again, I can tell you the projects we have on the book that I was talking about, the two veterans pumps, those are $18 million. It's under construction, so obviously we have the funding. Right. We're looking at, I think it's roughly $14 million out in Canner, where we have the Wood Lake Estates project, the West Esplanade project at the 17th Canal is roughly $12 million. And then I believe the Canner, I'm not sure what the cost of their project is. We do have one in River Ridge, Coventry Court, that's another $10 million. So the four that the parish has on the books are $54 million, but I have $18 million already of that funded. So you're looking at maybe $36 million. We do have capital outlay applications from the states to try to get some additional funding, and I think there'll be some movement because of this event to try to fund some of those projects. Our drainage department, we roughly get around $30 million a year, you know, capital projects. So we do have the ability to use that and leverage it if we can get some federal funds, and that'll take the match for state capital outlay. So it's got to be a combination of all, because as you well know, I mean, you know, taxes cover all of our systems, and raising taxes is just one part of it. So it is an option that we can do, but again, that we'll have to take a look at down the road.
What about alternative measures like water retention, porous concrete, those kind of things? Is that something that the parish would consider or look at, or is that a practical solution to any of this?
We've already looked at all that, Tommy. Your problem on the East Bank, like a part of this area, is it's so built out. We've taken advantage when we could. We pump into Pontiff Playground. It's a logical place where we actually temporarily store water. We actually pump into Causeway Earhart Interchange. We just actually completed a pump station to facilitate that so that we can take, it's basically Old Jefferson in that area. We pump a lot of the water, take it out of the system and pump it into Causeway Earhart. The first one we ever did was at Clearview and Earhart. We dug the ponds because we had significant problems there. So, but we don't have any other large areas of green space that are big enough to make a significant impact. We basically use those. So, you know, we're always looking for ways to do storage, but with a built-out East Bank, it's difficult.
Let me try to make it as simple as I possibly can. Is there any way that, given the rainfall that happened during Francine and the concentrated area where it happened, that Jefferson Parish will ever be without risk of flooding?
There's always going to be a risk of flooding. You know, I said if we make the improvements that we're talking about and a few more, we can significantly reduce the impacts that we saw. Mm-hmm. But again, it is a mechanical system. It is subject to failure at certain points. So can we ever completely, you know, eliminate the risk? No, but we can still significantly reduce the risk and minimize the structural flooding that you saw in this event by, you know, upgrading, not so much upgrading, by adding additional pumping capacity in the vicinity of those significant areas where we saw structure flooding.
Thank you. I appreciate your time, Mark, and the information. Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish. We come back, we're going to talk to the United Way about how you can help Francine victims. We'll also check in with the National Weather Service about that tropical system. And then the next half of the hour, we'll talk with the Downtown Development District about Canal Street. 8:15 now on this Tuesday morning. The storm is headed in. That storm that is in the Caribbean is expected to be a Category 2 or 3 when it heads into Florida. Sorry for them. Thankfully for us, we've had our turn with Francine. It's not coming here. Michelle Payne joins us now, Chief Strategy Officer for the United Way of Southeast Louisiana, talk about how you can help with relief efforts after Francine. Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
Good morning. Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the damage that Francine caused, and as a result, what kind of challenges that presents for the United Way of Southeast Louisiana.
Sure. Well, as we all know, it hit about a 2, and it did hit many of our families and parishes that we serve throughout our 7 parish region. We did find, thankfully, that it wasn't, mass disaster like it was for Hurricane Ida, but yet still a lot of families lost power or did get water in their homes, which, as we know, causes challenges for them. Just one family that maybe live in paycheck to paycheck, but yet lost an entire refrigerator full of food, that does cause a huge burden on them. So what we've been trying to do is provide people with supplies and gift cards and various ways just to kind of help support them in terms of getting back on their feet and helping their families recover from the hurricane.
I don't think people realize sometimes how, and look, everybody works hard. I'm not saying anybody gives anybody anything, but how sometimes some people are in a much better position than are others to deal with something like this when it happens, because for some it's an inconvenience, for others it becomes quite an obstacle.
Absolutely. And you took the words right out of my mouth. Inconvenience. I think for many of us, thankfully, we can say it's an inconvenience when we lose these things. But for some, actually we just did a pop-up out in Kenner at the Sam's Club, and I was speaking to one individual. And one of the things we were able to do was help them with their energy assistance, and it was to help turn their lights back on. And she said, when will this come through? And we explained kind of the time frame, how it will come through on their end. And she said, thank you so much. She goes, it's going to go off, and I'm just going to wait until it comes back on. So, that $200 that we were able to put back into their account made a huge difference of turning their lights back on. And then, there were other families that they needed the supplies so much that any food or any, cleaning supplies that we were able to supply to them really made a difference. And they were willing to come out and, come out and wait potentially in lines, that were hundreds deep to just get some supplies to help them recover.
I get the text from the hard cases or that think they're hard cases, but I wonder sometimes if they'd be so hard of a case if they were actually hit in the face with adversity. But when it comes to the people that you help, these are not people that refuse to work or don't want to work. These are hardworking people that just are struggling. Accurate?
Absolutely. What we call, we identify these individuals as ALICE. So it's an acronym that stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained but Employed. So it's often people working sometimes even more than one job to that point. And when we do these pop-up events, we actually try to time them to where it's either before work or after work, because a lot of them are, to your point, exactly going to work, working hard, and living paycheck to paycheck.
Tell me about the Francine Relief Fund, if you would, please, Michelle.
Sure. Yeah. So we have a fund open on our website. If you go to UnitedWaySELA.org, you can find it there on the homepage. But any relief efforts that we have going on, we use those funds. So whether it's individual gifts or it's corporate gifts, all of that money, 100% of what we bring in goes back out into the community. And we are so thankful to those that have stepped up. We know it's not a matter of when, that if it's going to happen, but a matter of when the next storm is. So really these efforts go back into the pockets of the individuals that really need the help, whether that's, able to get them supplies or gift cards or energy assistance. In this case, we were able to do so. Thankfully, we are very appreciative. Everyone, the collective impact made thus far has been over $103,000 raised, and we were able to help over 750 families. But we know, being out there and doing these pop-up events, that the need is even greater, and every dollar really makes a difference. So if anyone is listening and wants and feels compelled to give, we can ensure that it goes back to people who really need it most.
You can go to UnitedWaySELA.org, or if you're old school, you can mail a check to United Way of Southeast Louisiana, care of Francine Relief Fund, 2401 Canal Street, New Orleans, 70119. Tell people, if you will, what the donation is going to support.
Sure. So the donations go back right out into the community. So we host pop-up events We've thus far been able to do 5 different pop-up relief events, thanks to partners like Energy and others, and as well as just individual donations that come in. So collectively, we're able to go out into the communities that are hardest hit and provide them with essential supplies. So whether that's cleaning supplies, whether that's, we've done a lot of non-perishable foods, because this time a lot of people did lose everything that was in their refrigerators. In some cases, we're able to do gift cards. I mean, it really just kind of depends on those donations that are in and how we can be of most impact to those families out there.
If people are on the other side of it and they need help, how do they go about that?
Sure. We have wonderful resources available. We have 4 different prosperity centers throughout our 7 parish region. If you go to our website, you can find one of those prosperity centers. We encourage people to come in and work with our wonderful team and figure out if there are some resources available that we may be able to support them with. But we also have a wonderful website, that UnitedWaySELA.org/resources has a slew of resources, whether that's things available through state, federal, local. It's really a compilation of any sort of resources that we know of, that partners are offering, that we're offering, that are there. We also encourage people to follow us on social. That is actually how we put out our most information in terms of where we would be next. If we're going to have a pop-up, that's how we push it out. And we also utilize our wonderful partners as well to help communicate that out to their clients.
Thank you, Michelle. I appreciate your time and your efforts. You can go to United Way, SELA.org/Francine Relief. Or if you want to go old school and mail a check, send it to United Way of Southeast Louisiana, care of Francine Relief Fund, 2401 Canal Street, New Orleans, 70119. Next half hour, we're going to talk about Canal Street. Before that, we'll talk with the National Weather Service about the area, the potential tropical cyclone, I think they're referring to it, in the Caribbean now. 822 traffic, WWL. 827, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Tyler Stanfield, meteorologist at the National Weather Service. Talk about potential tropical cyclone 9, which is still in the Caribbean. But, Tyler, if you look at the models and what the hurricane hunters are saying, is there any real doubt about what's going to happen here?
From the most part, right now, we actually have a pretty good consensus on the forecast. The models have really kind of locked in on the track, and so our confidence has increased about the threat decreasing over our area. We don't expect direct impacts from this hurricane that's developing the eastern Gulf. So that is good news, but if you have any folks that are over in the Florida Panhandle, west coast of Florida, and they're not aware of this, definitely make sure that they're aware of it. We have hurricane watches that are now posted across much of the Big Bend of Florida and up over to Pensacola Beach in Tampa. So definitely make sure that you, if you have any folks over there, make sure that they're aware of the developing situation.
I know some people that live here on property over there. Is there a consensus on, and I know it's hard to predict an exact landfall, but if you had to pick an area in the Big Bend area, what would you say?
Right now, I mean, we're definitely going to see some more wobbles. I think the system's not fully developed yet. It's likely to become a tropical storm today and then quickly strengthen into a major hurricane as it gets to the eastern Gulf. But as that storm kind of gets itself together, there's definitely still more wobbles in place that could occur and cause that track to kind of waver back and forth. So it's pretty hard to nail down the exact location, kind of like you said. But really, like right now, our main focus in the track cone right now is the center of the storm could be anywhere between Apalachicola over to Tampa.
So Destin, for the most part, out of harm's way?
They'll be on the western side right now, is I think the main consensus. And the tropical storm watches extends just to the east of Destin over there. So not quite in the iron sights of the storm, but definitely be prepared in case, you know, we see any kind of sudden shifts in the track. It's definitely be able to monitor the forecast.
And so, as this thing makes its way inland, what about Sunday's game with the Saints in Atlanta? Any effects on the Atlanta area from this?
Sunday, yeah. We'll be seeing that storm push through over Friday and Saturday. It looks like it should be clearing out of that area by Sunday, though. We may have some lingering showers in the area, but relatively, fortunately, they have a dome, too. So just for the folks that are heading that way, yeah, maybe a little bit rainy, but the system itself should be weakening by that point out of the area.
Thank you, Tyler. Anything else beyond that in the Atlantic we need to worry about?
Not at this moment. We're not tracking anything else that's going to be a threat to our area.
So you give me the all clear for 7 to 10 days?
At least for the next 7 days, for sure.
That'll take us October. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Tyler Stanfield, the National Weather Service. Day at a time, and that's all we can do. We come back, we're going to talk about the redevelopment of Canal Street. And if y'all are old-timers, I'd like to hear from you about what Canal Street used to be like and how you would like to see it transformed today. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I've been looking forward to this. Dave and I got that right? Davon Barber joins us now. Sorry, sir. President and CEO of the Downtown Development District. Good morning. How you doing?
I'm fantastic. How are you, Tommy?
I'm okay, sir. Canal Street, I know from seeing some of the old movies, that, you know, they had a big Canadian Club sign there, I think, if I remember correctly, the advertising of bourbon or whatever it was. And it seemed like it was the Times Square of New Orleans. And would that be accurate or not?
You know, we're very unique, and I would say perhaps yes, in the historical context of New Orleans.
Tell me what the Downtown Development District ideally would like to see there, and what has it become, and where was it once? I guess maybe we can give a little historical context on it. Give us some.
Absolutely. Sure. So I think for many of your viewers who are not familiar with the Downtown Development District, we're actually the nation's first property-based assessment district in the country. And so what that means is the property owners located within our boundaries pay an extra ad valorem tax that funds our operations. And simply put, our mission is to ensure that downtown New Orleans is healthy and thriving and a great place for all. One of our key principles is to promote development. And so earlier this year, during our State of Downtown, we released our comprehensive economic development strategy. One of the core tenets of that economic development strategy is a renewed focus on Canal Street. You know, as you've kicked off this conversation, Canal Street is certainly important to this community given its history. We know the great stores that were located there, and it's important to maintain that focus. A lot of times when I'm out in the community, I remind everyone that just like that fine china or jewelry that we have in our closets, we've got to polish it from time to time. And this is a really exciting opportunity for us to continue that focus. We have been working alongside, you know, our colleagues in city government and the private sector to really bolster economic development along Canal Street. In fact, you know, a lot of people may not be aware of just the excitement that's taking place. Earlier this year, we launched the Canal Street Quarterly, which is a newsletter that focuses on all the improvements taking place in downtown New Orleans. And so we're excited about the future of Canal Street. We see this as a destination that offers a vibrant retail mix of both national as well as local tenants. It's a place where artists can showcase goods, and it's a place where people, again, you know, we want to create those Instagrammable moments where we're celebrating artwork, where there's vibrancy, there are people shopping, there are people living, there are people opening businesses along Canal Street.
People are texting in about the halcyon days of Maison Blanche and D.H. Holmes and Gotchaws and other places like that that were once on Canal Street. Has the business environment changed in terms of online shopping and so forth? I know malls are struggling, but is that something that could be possible for Canal Street, luring big merchants like that, or are those days gone, Davon?
Sure. I think it's a great question. I would say that the retail sector has absolutely evolved. You know, many of the mainstay brands that we've come and known, they've gone. You know, stores like Macy's, they announced that they were closing upwards of 150 stores nationwide. So I don't necessarily believe that we'll bring back, you know, the big box. Again, the retail industry is evolving. However, there is an opportunity, I believe, to bring in and cultivate many of our local brands. I really envision a place where, you know, local entrepreneurs are filling a void in the merchandise mix along Canal Street. I also see an opportunity for other national brands to come along Canal Street as well. We've got some great activity generators. You know, when we analyze foot traffic along Canal Street, we continue to see year-over-year growth in visitation. That's really strong. In fact, you know, we have a number of visitors that travel more than 250 miles on a regular basis, more than 30%. We regularly see that. So I do think, you know, the days of sort of big box retail are gone. Online shopping has definitely impacted the retail sector. However, at the end of the day, when you look at countless studies, it shows that consumers really love brick and mortar. And as New Orleans, we love our local businesses.
That, and you know, it seems like tourists, if you look at the hotels in the area, sometimes tourists like to get out and shop. Look at what happens in New York. Look at what happens in Chicago and San Francisco and other areas. Let me take a break. When you come back, if you can, Devon, maybe you can give me some examples of other cities that have a street like this, a main drag, if you want to call it that, that you would like to see Canal Street maybe develop into. And if y'all have any ideas, 504-260-1870, I'd love to hear from you. I would love to see Canal Street come back to just have some shops and some restaurants, and it would be a great area for tourists to walk as at night, well-lit, safe, secure from the hotels. Text me, 504-260-1870. We're talking to Devon Barber, President and CEO of the Downtown Development District. City Council is looking for ways to redevelop the Canal Street and make it back to what it once was, 851 or maybe even better, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWO. 8:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWO, talking to Devon Barber, President and CEO of the Downtown Development District, about Canal Street. Somebody texted in and said, Tommy, the stores were absolutely stunning back then. I remember shopping with my mom at Gus Meyer, Gold Rings, and Labiche's. The store clerks wore white gloves, and you were expected to be dressed when you shopped there. It was also a very clean and beautiful street. Well, I don't think white gloves are coming back, nor maybe people dressing up when they go shopping. But, Devon, there, I would think there are streets in other cities. I mentioned maybe New York or Chicago or San Francisco or even Market Street. Somebody texted in Denver. That would be maybe some examples of what you would like to see.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I thought about this quite a bit, and in terms of our general downtown planning, I'd have to say, you know, when I look to downtown Chicago, Michigan Avenue by far is, for me, is the gold standard. I think there are a lot of similar characteristics. For those who travel, you know, downtown Chicago, Magnificent Mile has phenomenal retail, great landscaping, great streetscape. You get a sense of just strong responsibility, both from the public sector and private sector, in curating this great retail experience. And so when I think about the future of Canal Street, I look a lot to Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago.
I would think that one would rapidly build on the other, would build on the other, would build on the other. But how do you get somebody to go first?
You know, it's interesting. I fundamentally believe that it's the role of the public sector to prime the pump. You know, capital doesn't just drop from the sky. We've got to give investors a reason and a sense of hope. And so, you know, that's why we're doubling down on our cleaning efforts. We're partnering with others to enhance public safety in our district. We're focused on key partnerships that really create what I like to describe as these Instagrammable moments. Well, let me give you an example. You know, when you're visiting Canal Street, it's not just simply about being on Canal Street, but it's also about the approach to Canal Street. And so we are delighted to partner with the state of Louisiana and also GNO Inc. To deploy what we're calling our French Door strategy. This is a beautification effort along five key blocks that connect to Canal Street: the 100 block of Dauphine, the 100 block of Bourbon, the 100 block of Charter, Decatur, and Royal. And so over the coming weeks, you will start to see key investments in terms of new public art, decorative lighting, sidewalk repairs, again, enhancing the shopping experience. And so we're very, very excited about that.
Is there a way for people to send in ideas or offer suggestions?
Absolutely. I would say, certainly I encourage all of your listeners to join our website. So if you sign up for our newsletter and visit downtownnola.com, you can sign up there to receive our weekly updates, as well as to subscribe to the quarterly Canal Street Quarterly. We welcome that feedback all the time. Our social media, we like to broadcast everything that we're working on. So, yes, we absolutely welcome that feedback. We want to hear what we want our citizens to be engaged in this process.
And we'd love to see it. I think it's a great asset that is being undervalued. Thank you, sir. Devon Barber, President and CEO of the Downtown Development District. We take a break. Come back, talk to Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. It is 9:31. We're always concerned about mental health here at WWL, and we spend every other Tuesday talking to our friend Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. And today we're going to talk about boredom and kids. Good morning, Dr. Judy. How are you?
Good morning. How are you, Tommy?
I'm okay. Dr. Judy, fresh off of her appearance at SoFi Stadium where she watched her 49ers play the Rams. Accurate?
Don't even talk about it. Yeah. I'm so bummed out about that game. But, yeah, it was nice to see them in person, obviously.
Did you have fun at least?
Until the tides turned. Yeah. Until the tides turned. But you know what? There was so many more 49ers fans at the stadium. I mean, it was like home game. It was ridiculous. Yeah. So I was at least in good company.
It did. It looked like a 49er home game. It really did. Let's talk about kids and what the neuroscience shows about always keeping them. You know, sometimes we think that we always have to have the electronic device in the kids' hands, or they always have to be quiet or kept occupied, or this or that or the other thing. What does the research show, Dr. Judy?
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting, right? We've kind of, you know, I read this article on Psychology Today that your staff was so kind to send me. And, you know, it was about sort of earlier generations being raised, basically being bored and figuring things out to do, right? And actually, that probably sharpens your imagination and also builds distress tolerance, I would think, because it's really about, you know, well, when you can't have what you want exactly when you want it, what are you going to do about it? You know, and that's a good life skill. I think, obviously, it's always one of those things where sometimes too much of a good thing maybe gets a little too extreme and then it's not so good. And I think that good thing is that we've started to learn that, hey, parents should be more hands-on with their children, right? And so now we're constantly trying to entertain our kids at every turn. And, oh, you have to, no matter how long of a work day you had, you still have to spend dedicated time with your kids when you come home. You know, there's all of these things that I think feel a lot more like what is supposed to be good parenting these days. And maybe parents are working a little too hard. That's a possible interpretation of that. That's probably why, as we talked about a few weeks ago, the Surgeon General's warning about parenting stress being at an all-time high, because parents are working out of the house. They're busy. They're full-time employed. At the same time, they're also spending more than ever time with their children when they do have free time. And that's a lot. You know, when do you have time for yourself, or when do you have time just to decompress, do the things that you want to do for a change? And maybe that's the piece that we should know, that it's okay sometimes if you're not constantly with your kid doing things that they want to do. Maybe it's okay sometimes that they're figuring it out for themselves.
And yet, as I read this, I think that, you know, what's the old saying? Idle hands are the devil's workshop. You got to keep them busy.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, you know, again, I think it's all about moderation, right? Like, you can't just have them sitting around all the time and expect them to figure things out and learn things. I mean, you do have to stimulate them. You do have to teach them. You do have to, you know, do things that help them to challenge themselves. So it's probably just like anything else. Maybe the answer is somewhere in between. Like, hey, whenever you can and you have the capacity, you know, try to challenge your children, try to spend quality time with them. But, you know, every once in a while when you're just too tired, or it's not really possible, or maybe you're dealing with your own stuff and you just need a night off, maybe that's okay too.
You know, I was watching some of the funeral coverage of Sybil Morial yesterday, and Mark Morial, mm-hmm. her son, was saying that, you know, if you were her child, you had chores, you had this, you had that, you had responsibilities, you had to do this. Do chores sometimes get left out of this? And would that be talk about the importance, I guess, of chores when it comes to raising kids, what the research indicates about not only keeping them entertained and occupied, but giving them something to do and contributing to the family and a feeling of accomplishment, et cetera.
Oh, absolutely. Chores are, I think, essential. I don't remember when I had chores. I don't think that, you know, they're called chores in our house. I mean, it's just like things that we did, right? I was born in Taiwan, so I didn't come to the United States until about age 9. And so I don't really actually know what the equivalent of the word chores is in Mandarin, because I don't think we use them in our household. Or maybe there isn't one. I don't know. But, you know, we didn't really call them chores. I just had responsibilities. And it's pretty much as far back as I remember. And so, you know, Luca, he's almost 3. And he's been doing, you know, quote unquote chores. I mean, I don't know, since he was maybe 1, 1.5. I mean,
really?
It's developmentally appropriate. Like, he helps me to put the laundry in because he thinks that it's fun. He thinks it's fun when I'm doing chores. I mean, that's how it started. Look,
I didn't think you had to pave in a driveway or anything. I wasn't saying that.
No way. I mean, listen, you know, just because I'm a psychologist, like obviously far from a perfect parent, this all started organically because he started getting interested in the things that I was doing. And I was like, oh, well, you want to help mommy do her laundry? So he would, you know, help me load the clothes into you know, the laundry, and then he would into the washing machine, and then he would, you know, close the door and press the button. And so he's been doing that, you know, for at least a year, and then he sees me putting dishes away, so I started having him put his own dishes away. He can't reach the higher cabinets, but he can reach his cabinet, right, where his dishes are. So I was like, well, you can put your stuff away. So that's kind of how that all started happening. It was a very organic process. I didn't force it. But then I realized, oh, he's interested in what I'm doing. So he helps me cook, right, even though, of course, he's 2.5. He's very supervised. But it's like, okay, well, you can mix the batter for the pancakes. And so kids actually, you know, if you give them the chance, they like observing what adults are doing. They want to be like you, right? And that's a perfect chance to get in there and be like, okay, well, you know, why don't you help me with some of these daily activities? And then as they get older, obviously you can expand on how much they can do.
Somebody texted in and said, my kids look at board games, B-O-A-R-D, as B-O-R-E-D games, board games. What can you say about, I think there is something to be said about a family getting together and playing a good old-fashioned board game where you're talking to each other in between rolls of the dice, et cetera?
Oh, yeah. I love board games, but probably took a little while before I developed an interest in them. I tried to buy some, you know, what I thought were age-appropriate board games. Believe it or not, they do make them for two-year-olds. But yeah, no, Lucas not having it. I mean, he's like, what is this? So I think that maybe it's a developmental thing. Maybe it's a personality thing. But I think if you make it a family activity and it's structured and it's kind of like what everyone's just going to do that night, that can be helpful. You know, it's not forcing it down their throat, but it's kind of like, hey, once a month, our Saturday night activity is we're going to play board games. And, you know, you're going to participate. So either you bring the game that you like or you're going to play what we have on the table, right? And I do think there's something to be said about, I guess, what we would call nowadays analog entertainment, because it's not virtual entertainment. It's not as fast paced. It's not like YouTube, you know, when you get bored of a video, you just switch to the next one because they've got the sidebar scrolling with all other kinds of videos that might interest you. You know, board games, I mean, there's one objective and you have to finish the game, right? I mean, you could walk away from it, but then what's the alternative? I guess another board game if it's family board game night. So you have to be able to kind of sit through one thing. And I've been talking to a lot of parents of toddlers and younger children. And, you know, of course, it's like, people give varying levels of screen time, but I think YouTube is the hardest because every 2 minutes, if they're bored of something, they just immediately scroll to the next video. But if you actually have them sit down and watch a full-length cartoon or even a cartoon movie, at the very least, it's one objective, it's one theme, right? And they're watching something from start to end, which I think overall is a little bit better for emotional regulation and development than YouTube videos where literally it's like, everybody's just developing attentional issues in a way.
Can you sit down, Dr. Judy Ho, and watch a movie without picking up your phone? And I guess it depends on the movie.
That is a good question, Tommy. Yes, that is a really good question. And I would say that I oftentimes, when I start watching something, will start to get this feeling like I need to pick up my phone. Uh-huh. And a lot of times I do, and I'm like, oh, you know, and don't do that. But it's such a habit, right? We're so used to stimulation from all angles, you know, doing multiple things at a time. And I literally have to tell myself before I start a movie, I'm going to watch this without picking up anything else. Like, I have to remind myself, right? So that's what's crazy about it. Like, it kind of develops insidiously. Sometimes you don't realize that now you're doing everything that, you know, you say you're not going to do. So it is a habit that I have to essentially consciously make an effort to break.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, 504-260-1870. I think I have a way to keep kids entertained that I think we've gotten away from that had a lot to do with me developing the way I did, which may be a good thing, maybe a bad thing. I don't know, but it taught me a lot of things. I will explain what that is when we come back, talking to Dr. Judy Ho, and it still does, as a matter of fact, today. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. If you have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870, 941-19 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 946, 14 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Dr. Judy Ho. Doctor, a text comes in and says our four-year-old child has an anger problem. He throws a fit uncontrollably when he doesn't get what he wants. Also, he doesn't always listen. It'll take four times for us to say stop XYZ before he stops. 4 years old. Thoughts?
Yeah. So, you know, tantrums are the most common between the ages of 2 to 5. Mm-hmm. And occasional tantrums
are... Not if you work around here. I'm just kidding.
Well, as I said, most common. It just didn't ever happen again.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you know, I understand the distress. And it's so sad to see your kids having a tantrum. I mean, Luca just had one last night. And he hasn't had one that bad in months and months and months. And so sometimes it can happen. I think the biggest thing is... really watching, well, first of all, how often is it occurring? I mean, if it's happening multiple times a week and the tantrums are going on for 30 minutes or longer each time, you know, that's not normative. And it is time to consult with a professional who can teach you some skills, both parenting skills and also child self-regulation skills to help with that. But I think if it's somewhat normative, but obviously just distressing because it's happening with somewhat of a frequency and it's clearly upsetting whenever it does happen, you know, it's really important to keep in mind a couple of things. One is only have one person managing the person when they're in the middle of a tantrum. So sometimes everybody wants to pitch in, you know, mom and dad and grandma, everybody has something to say to the person, try to calm them down. That's too overwhelming for a child when they're in the middle of a tantrum. So just have one person be the person to communicate with the child. I think the second thing is always to make sure that you speak in short sentences. You know, they're not going to be hearing your reasoning as you reason out, you know, why they couldn't get this toy or why they have to leave their friend's house at this point. It's got to just be really short. And there's little things that you can do to try to help them to self-soothe, like either demonstrating for them what to do, or sometimes if they're younger, like a four-year-old, I think sometimes you can still just kind of sit there and just hold them. Mm-hmm. If they don't want to be held, then you just tell them, like, do like mommy, take deep breaths, right? Or like, do you need some quiet time? Let's sit down here. You know, things that are very, very simple for a child to grasp and just helps them to learn emotion regulation skills at a developmentally appropriate phase. After the tantrum is over, then you have to talk about it. Sometimes you're just like, oh, big sigh of relief. I don't want to deal with this. Doesn't have to be immediate, but it should be within a few hours and say, you know, just a little while ago, you had this big tantrum. Can we talk about what that was? Can you tell me how I can help you next time when you get this upset so that we can prevent this from happening? Because that was upsetting for you and it was upsetting for me too. One tool that I found is really helpful is to get one of those emotional cards or emotional flip books that they sell on Amazon. They're pretty cheap. And it helps kids to communicate their feelings when they don't know, right? So if they don't know the word, they can at least point to the picture of how they feel. And that's a good starting place. Okay, well, you were mad. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what we can do when we're mad.
Somebody texted in. This is not a bad question. Is there an average time for a tantrum? Is there a time limit on a tantrum where it's like, okay, that's enough?
Yeah, that's a good related question. So I think, again, anything from a few minutes to 20 minutes, unbelievably, are normative. And I know that that's stressful when you think about it as a parent, and those 20 minutes can feel like forever. But usually they are able to be distracted after a period of time. So obviously, maybe not in the first 5 minutes. But after a period of time, most kids can be directed to something else. And so that is one way to try to shift them off of that. I think that if it's getting to 30 minutes multiple times a week, like I just mentioned, that is a little too much, and I think it's time to consult a professional.
I mentioned this earlier. What taught me a lot, and I know a lot about a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. I know a little about a lot of different things. Let's put it that way. Maybe not, you know, I'm not an engineer or anything, but you know what did that, Dr. Judy? Reading. Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I used to love these biographies of people I would read. I would read novels. I would not know what this word meant, so I would look it up. It developed vocabulary. It kept me entertained. I think we've gotten away from that, and I think with the electronic devices, and I'm not trying to sound like an old-timer or anything, but actually I'm reading a novel now, and I was talking to Jordan about this the other day, our producer, that it had been a long time since I'd done any recreational reading because I read so much for work. It's kind of nice. Have we gotten away from that? Do you think maybe that could be an answer if people could just get kids to read again?
Yeah, I mean, I love reading, but it was definitely something that I had to develop over time. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is very, very likely that we have gotten away from that because there's all of these other things that are stimulating us all the time. And so reading is great because obviously it helps you to develop really important English reading comprehension or whatever language that you prefer to read in, language comprehension skills. It also helps to develop your imagination. It actually does help to develop emotional regulation and distress tolerance because, you know, when there isn't anything else to do and you're bored and you're reading, it can become a favorite activity. Plus, of course, it's easy to take anywhere, to take a book somewhere. And so I do think that when you give a child a structured amount of time to read, that is a helpful way to do it. And, you know, if you're at home, you can just say, okay, 30 minutes before bedtime, go grab your favorite book and, like, we're all going to read. It's easiest if parents are doing the same thing, right? If you're going to tell your kid to do it, you got to do it too. So you got to put your device away and you pick a book and they pick a book and you guys just read side by side. And sometimes, you know, maybe they want to show you something in their book. That's fine. But for the most part, they're reading on their own. And I think that that is an amazing activity. I'm so glad that you brought that up.
And it can just expose you to so many other things where what happened for me was like, it's, wait, what is that? What is all that about? That was not part of my life. But then I realized that there were things beyond my immediate circle that was happening in the world. It makes sense to you?
Right. Plus, it's a conversation starter. I mean, we've all been in those situations, right? I mean, if you think back to your childhood, you know, maybe there was like a hot book everybody was reading and then like you would talk about it. Like, oh, hey, like, did you get to chapter 10 or did you finish the book? I mean, it's something to discuss with your peers. And most of the times, I think my peers and I were reading the same book, whether it was because at school or because we had similar interests. And it was always a great way to have a conversation.
Godfather, page 17. Just kidding. Dr. Judy, thank you. And have a great have a great week. And we'll talk to you again soon. Say hi to Luca. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Newell is out on location today. We'll talk to him about what he's got coming up for you when we return here on WWL.